Welcome to the Phi Life Podcast. I'm John Barbin, and with me is Brad Pilon. And today's topic is something Brad hasn't even told me yet, so you might as well just get rolling.
I figured, I mean, last week we talked about packaging, right? And I was sort of going off about how important packaging is. I was kind of downplaying ingredients a bit. So I figured it'd be fair to our ingredient people out there and also give people kind of just an inside look into how this all works. I was going to suggest that people maybe check out a supply side expo. Right? For people who don't know what that is, it's a giant meeting, like an expo hall. So just rows and rows and rows of booths, kind of like at a, you know, if you go to the Arnold's or the Mr. Olympia, where you'd see supplement companies that have their booths set up and you go from booth to booth checking out the newest wares that these supplement companies are selling. Well, if you go to something like supply side, you have rows and rows and rows of booths and booths and booths of people pitching their raw materials, which are the ingredients. So it's really cool because if you could ever get access to one of these supply side shows, what you're seeing is exactly what you're going to see in a bodybuilding supplement company show just 3 years earlier, right? Because it's, you know, it's typically a company, you know, so John and I start up and decide we're going to start up a company. We have a novel way of spray drying blueberry extract, right? So John was a food chemist and I'm a marketing guru, so we come up with this idea. We're like, man, we got to get this into products. We don't actually want to make a product. That's not our thing. We're not good, you know, marketers for that kind of thing. Well, let's go down the supply side. We'll set up a booth and we'll try to reel in some customers. Only our customers are the supplement companies, right? Not just bodybuilding. In this case, it would be anything. You'd probably put spray-dried blueberry in, I don't know, cosmetics, right? And cosmetic people will be there. So you meet with people and you pitch why your ingredient would be a great addition to their products. So for a lot of people, I'm sure you kind of think that the supply chain kind of ends at the supplement company, right? Whether it's or the you know, the cosmetic company or even, you know, the food company. But it's, there's a large step back where it's actually the raw material companies pitching to them. Another thing that would be really cool is if you – I believe it's NutriIngredients.com or NutriIngredients USA. But then what you get there is sort of the suppliers side of things. And this is where the suppliers will shoot basically – the same way that research gets marketed to us, you know, quick blurbs about how great something is, well, the suppliers do that same technique, you know, to the potential buyers of supplement companies or cosmetic companies, et cetera. So you talk about, you know, air bubbles may help cut salt and sugar from Unilever, right? So Unilever obviously is a supplier or an alpha manufacturer in this case. Whole grain diet, again, linked to heart health. From the bakeryandsnacks.com. So you can obviously see there's a little bit of an obvious push here, right? So it's always – there's an on-your-radar section, and here you have omega-3, then a couple bolts about omega-3s and probiotics and a couple pushes from the probiotic people. So it's really interesting if you get a chance to look at the way the raw material suppliers market to the supplement companies who then take that message and market it to you.
Mm-hmm. And then – And that's kind of why a new ingredient gets adopted by multiple brands and it'll hit the market sort of
right
as
at the same time.
Kind of all at the same time. Because behind the scenes, those ingredient suppliers are trying to get as many companies on board as possible.
Yeah, unless you can get one of the big guys and you give them exclusivity.
But or get the biggest fish and get them exclusive.
Yeah.
But in either case, they're always trying to expand their market share and they're always trying to get as many adopters as possible with a particular ingredient.
Yeah.
So there's an entire second level of the industry that you would never see, and you don't realize if you didn't know this, that you wouldn't know that a new ingredient is coming in, if there's a surplus of it, it's at a good price, and it's got some good marketing claims behind it, and that's why all of a sudden it shows up in everybody's product.
Yeah.
That's because there's a hard push going on behind the scenes for everyone to start selling it.
Absolutely. And then also, if you happen to be a you know, a nutrition major or doing a graduate degree in nutrition, the key here is also is that working in a supplement shop, a supplement company is not your only option. You can actually work for one of these ingredient companies because the more creative they are and the more ingredients they have or the more variations of ingredients, you know, the better they're going to succeed. And John, you and I can both think of certain companies who have certain testosterone promoting herbs, have the same herb every year at these supply shows, have been there for the last 8 years. Nothing new, no new research, no new branding, just the same product. right? And that obviously that's all they have. Whereas when you watch some of the other ones go, man, they come up with crazy new things every year. You know, mm-hmm. a new, you know, methylated version of this or ester version of that, right? And that's what keeps them alive and kicking, because in an industry that craves novelty, you got to supply it, right? And the industry isn't the customer who craves novelty. It's the supplement companies who want novelty, because if they see something really novel no one else has and they look at it and they're instantly like, oh, I can build a story around this, well, then you've got a winner, right? So just a thought out there for any, you know, potential graduates looking for jobs. It's not just the supplement industry. You can get into the actual raw material side of things, which is just as fun and just as cool.
Yeah, and if you have, I guess supply side happens twice, right? There's East and West.
East, West, there's supply side Asia. There, I mean, the cool thing about the raw materials thing is you get to travel a lot too. But supply side's not by any means the only one. I mean, there's shows everywhere. I think there's one in Vancouver this weekend. Like it's,
oh, yeah, and there's Expo West and East.
Yep. So
the Expo West is in Anaheim, supply side's in Vegas, and then East is, I don't know if East is consistent. I know it was in Baltimore before. I don't know where else it shows up. But it's, you could just Google search it and find out. And if you happen to be in those areas, you can go through and see the workings of the industry behind, not at the retail level, not at the stuff you see, but at the stuff that the people who are selling you the final product, what they're being pitched. And then you can kind of follow the train.
Yeah, no, absolutely. It's just really interesting to see where the raw materials come from. Obviously, you guys aren't most likely ever going to have a chance to go and check out the actual facility that makes them, et cetera. Like, really, from the picked. Some places have such control that they literally own the field where the herb is picked. And then, you know, they own the entire process all the way down to the concentrating and powdering of the – and that's really cool to see. I had the pleasure of seeing that actually with some green tea manufacturing in China. And just watching the detail they go in terms of, you know, what leaves get picked based on their height on the plant and that plant's height along the mountainside, and then the process from there. It starts off being very organic and earthy, not organic in terms of like the North American organic food, just sort of down and dirty, to then being like, you know, in a complete GMP facility with, you know, perfect cleanliness, et cetera. So you're literally picking plants out of the soil, and then by the end having like a very sterile spray-dried product, which then again always brings me back to my my interest that, you know, people who are so against you know, fortified foods or processed foods, but are okay with herbs that have gone through probably some of the most stringent processing I've ever seen.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Well, that just brings up the whole concept. Well, yeah. I mean, supplements are the most highly processed food you can have.
Oh, a vitamin and mineral? Are you kidding me? Yeah, like a protein. Think of a protein powder. I mean, that is the most processed form of cheese manufacturing runoff you can possibly find. I mean, processed down to the point where it's so processed, at least typically you don't have to worry about things like bacteria counts, et cetera, which is amazing if you think about it. It's a protein, and they've gotten the moisture levels down so low that it's not at risk of going bad.
Yeah, whey protein supplements or products are a byproduct of processing such that they sort of inadvertently figured out, oh my God, we can actually make a viable, sellable product out of this.
Absolutely.
But at the beginning, it was just, like you said, it was a runoff, it was a buildup, and they were like, well, we can't really do anything with this, and they eventually figured out how to concentrate it. So, processing is such a misunderstood concept. A lot of things are processed so that they are edible versus
or safe.
Yeah, so they are. Yeah, so that you can actually consume things like they, you know, pasteurization. They get rid of bacteria. They make things that are otherwise just useless into something that's actually useful. So
yeah.
It's a bit of the fallacy of that. There's, you know, all processing is bad. There's no such thing as things that are unprocessed. The minute you pull something out of a field and wash it, that washing's the first level of processing.
Yeah, and if you don't want that thing going bad in 5 days, processing.
Yeah. Yeah,
I mean, it's...
Yeah, you preserve it. You do something to it. I mean, you cook it, something. You got to do something to it. Like, can you even think of a food you'd go out in the wild and just eat right there?
Me? Berries, if I couldn't wash them, but past that. I mean, the key is beyond that is, I mean, what's one of the main questions you ask when you're talking with the raw material manufacturers? Okay, what's the shelf life on this?
Mm-hmm.
Because your product has to be, your finished product two years at a minimum, right? Like, it's so that product has to be so processed, and so sterile, that it can sit in a tub on a shelf for 3 years. And at the end of that 3 years, if it were tested, it would still contain the same macronutrients, right? And no increase in bacteria content. That's some hardcore processing.
Mm-hmm. And that's not, it's not a bad thing. It's otherwise you just wouldn't have nearly the access you do to the different foods that are available.
Yeah. Absolutely.
And it's just kind of the way it is. I still don't get why people are. I don't get that whole like anti-processing thing, because that discussion's come up on my blog a few times, and I think there's an assumption that processing itself is just what's categorized as bad or not good or not natural, and that it's somehow. And I mean, just talking about processing as a general term doesn't make sense either, because, well, what kind of process are you talking about? There's dozens, hundreds of different processes things go through, and unless you're very specific on which one and what happens to the product, I don't think people really understand what processing even means.
No, I would agree. But which is just another reason to go to one of these supply shows, because it's not just the raw materials guys who are there, but it's also the, you know, they're most of the time they're not just pitching the ingredient, they're pitching the process. Right? I mean, think of the instantized whey protein. Think of all the different types of microfiltering you see. You know, it's not just spray dried, it's nanoparticulated, right? These are all processes that are being pitched because, well, A, because some of them just sound sexy, and B, because they actually have some sort of value to you.
Yeah, yeah, like cross filtering and
exactly
ionization and all that kind of stuff. It's, you know, it's the, oh yeah, completely. I mean, the processing, at least in the supplement industry, in some cases is a claim.
Yep, absolutely.
So, I mean, you end up on two sides of the spectrum. You end up on the side where, I guess, some customers, at least, I'd say it's more the hardcore bodybuilding group that get into that, and they actually think a particular kind of processing produces a better product. And then you have, on the other end of the spectrum, you have people who are more into this romanticism about what's natural, and that the less processing, the better.
Absolutely, yeah. But, I mean, yeah, you'll see all angles of it at a supply show. So just something to keep in mind. If you're interested in health and fitness and sort of all aspects of where our beliefs and ideals come from, right? And we typically account, I guess, is the supplement industry being sort of the creator of a lot of the beliefs and a lot of the claims. But a lot of times it's been pitched to them, and it's been pitched to them by the raw materials manufacturers and their processing and or the people developing processing. So it'd be really interesting to sort of trace back a claim all the way to its birth and inception, because it's not always in the boardrooms and marketing departments of supplement companies. Sometimes it's way, way before that.
Oh yeah, yeah, completely. And as far like, and the like you said when you were talking about seeing the whole process go from right from the plant to the processing plant in China, I think people think a particular ingredient in a particular product is always the same ingredient from the same place, which isn't the case. Not at least in every product. So in other words, if you're buying green tea from a particular company, there's no guarantee that each bottle of green tea you buy over the course of a year came from the same supplier.
Excellent point. Yeah. I mean, oftentimes you're switching three or four suppliers in and out, depending A, who has supply, B, who can meet timelines, C, who's got the right price, who's got a bonus going on, or maybe they have another ingredient you want to get your hands on, so you bought some of their green tea because you wanted some of their, I don't know, white tea or something like that. But yeah, so in the course of the exact same product, you know, Brad and John's Magic Weight Loss Elixir, you know, the one you bought in September versus the one you bought in November, same ingredient, completely different manufacturer.
Different source.
Or source, yeah.
Yeah, so we could be selling you a capsule with 300 milligrams of green tea, mm-hmm. but over the course of a year, and you're our loyal customer, and you stick with us, but we don't stick with the supplier. We've sold you four different sources of green tea over the course of that year.
Yeah,
so exactly. And like Brad said, we're going off of various items like cost, whether or not we get a package deal if we're buying other ingredients from them. Maybe we were buying from China, but they had a drought, so now we're buying from India or somewhere else. And that's never going to be reflected on the label. You're never going to know that the product you're buying, the ingredient itself, its source is constantly changing. And I mean, this isn't unusual. This is pretty standard stuff.
Absolutely. No, absolutely. And it's something to consider, yeah, when you're buying a box. I guess technically we could say this now, but we could kind of expand this out of supplements and talk about food in general. When you're buying a box of whatever, you know, you don't know where that flour came from. You don't know where the sugar came from. It may have came from, you know, someplace in North America and then someplace not in North America, from the East Coast and the West Coast, all over the place. That doesn't have to be disclosed to you in any way. So, and that's one of the problems. A very good company using a very good quality assurance program can actually trace us back. So let's say back to John My Magic Elixir, we had to do a recall because one of our products had one of the green teas we bought, maybe the one from, I don't know, some random company, ended up there's something wrong with it. If we were doing proper QC and QA through the system.
What do those mean?
Quality control and quality assurance. Sorry. We could actually track every lot number that we produced that had that ingredient in it. And that's why the good companies, the big companies, tend to be a little bit on the safer side because they have these protocols in place, right? So they can literally write down to the what's the lot number on your box? Oh, it's, you know, 4442. Okay, no, that one's fine. But 4443, yeah, we use it in that bottle. Right? Mm-hmm. So right down to the individual bottle, you can tell where those ingredients came from. They have that information. The unfortunate thing is you, as a consumer, don't.
Mm-hmm. And it's nothing that you're going to be privy to. And which may explain, I'm not saying it does, but may explain why sometimes you get a reaction off one product and not 6 months later on the same brand.
Yeah,
because the potency of the ingredient put in each product may differ from lot to lot, depending on the consistency of the menu of the source. So now it's depending on, you know, us with our magic elixir. If we're ordering ingredients from various sources, if we don't do enough due diligence to make sure the extraction technique is the same and the like Brad said, the QE and the QA and the QC. If we're not on top of that, we could end up every now and then having a batch sold to us that's not as good as the last one. And then we're just passing that on to you because we're selling it, you know, assuming we've got a standard ingredient. And that's a bit of a problem too. Like, for instance, the Canadian government is trying to regulate all of this, but they never considered the different sources. So when you try to apply for your natural health product license, if you're selling, let's say we had a simple two-ingredient product, and it was based on, you know, 300 milligrams of green tea and 300 milligrams of, something else, Hootie or whatever. Mm-hmm. Nowhere in the application process does it explain the consistency of the ingredient from lot to lot. Or the differences in potencies you can end up with multiple different extraction processes.
Absolutely.
So I can have 100% compliant product with a natural health product number and everything based on the Canadian government standards. And I could be ordering my raw ingredient from a supplier who extracts, from different suppliers who extract the raw ingredient four or five different ways, either like a liquid, an alcohol extraction, a water extraction, different extraction methods, and that yield different potencies of active ingredients. Yet I have approval to sell you 300 milligrams green tea. But the 300 milligrams, based on the supplier and the extraction process, and like Brad was saying, when it's harvested, how it's harvested, the potency can be wildly different. But under the law, it all looks the same. But if I'm not really on top of my stuff, I could be delivering multiple different potencies with each lot.
Yep. No. Absolutely.
So it's difficult to actually kind of nail this down. It's not like a pharmaceutical that's identical. Every capsule or every pill is identical to the last one. Raw material, like herbs specifically, can end up the closer they get to a pharmaceutical, the more standardized the dose and the more repeatable, the more predictable that what you're getting is. But the more, I guess, natural it is, and the less stringent the process is for extracting and concentrating it, the more variable the effect you're going to get. So when it comes to...
And we should point out that it's not just... I mean, John and I talk about supplements because it's the industry we're knowledgeable in. But it's the same story with just about all food and consumables, right? Is that you switch things out, things can change all over the place. So that's it. This is something that's exclusive to supplements by any means.
Oh, and especially in the food industry, they have to be super careful about that, because if they throw the taste off with a product that has a known taste, and you switch up sweeteners or switch up an ingredient because it's cheaper, huge backlash if a customer who comes in and is a regular purchaser of a product. And like, could you imagine if Mini Wheats use a different type of frosting?
Yeah, unheard of.
And then it came out with a different flavor, there'd be a mutiny.
Well, you know, with the perfect historical example of that is New Coke.
Oh, New Coke, perfect example.
Wow. Did they backtrack on that one, right?
Yeah, and that was a multi-million-dollar, multi-hundreds of million-dollar mistake.
Yeah.
You can't, you know, once you're – and at least with most supplements, we don't have to deal with taste. But if you have a flavor system in place, like, you know, capsule and tablet-type products, there's no taste involved. But with proteins and pre-workout supplements
– it's all about – if you're going to survive in the marketplace, you better be spending – well, like our last call, I think tons of time on packaging, and then as equal amount of time on flavor. Mm-hmm. And you better be improving flavor every quarter.
But you cannot mess up a flavor that's already known. Like if you botch it by trying to go with a cheaper sweetener, your product could stop selling the next day when that batch hits the shelf.
Oh, you know what's a fantastic example of that? Is Cocos. For any chocolate protein powder. Because the rest of the powder is so relatively inert. Like, I don't know if people know, but whey protein doesn't have a lot of flavor to it. And then the rest of the ingredients generally don't have a lot of flavor to it. So when you're doing a chocolate powder, it's typically just a cocoa and then sometimes a vanilla flavor to kind of mellow out the cocoa. Mm-hmm. But from cocoa to cocoa, massive differences in the taste, the mouthfeel, the texture, the look. All right, so it's you got to be really careful not to just switch out. And you got to be really careful the manufacturer of that specific cocoa could meet your supply demands. Because if you somehow hit a home run with a protein shake and all of a sudden your supplier can't meet demand, and now you're using two suppliers but back and forthing. So, you know, the batch I bought in November tasted amazing. The batch I bought in December, not so good. But in January I bought a batch that was amazing again. That's not a good thing either, right? Inconsistency is never a good thing from the consumer's eyes.
Right. And then I was just going to bring that up. And then you could be trapped in this situation where you're married to the one flavor house that knows how to make the flavor that turned into the home run flavor.
Exactly.
And then if you switch to a different flavor house who can outcompete them on cost, and so you go with like a 50% cheaper cocoa, but everyone hates the flavor, you won't be long until no one's buying your product anymore. So you're kind of stuck there, and you don't want to play with your flavor once you've got it. Like, I remember back in the day when EAS had their Mesotech single serving packets,
yep.
And their vanilla cream was like, or their strawberry cream was the best and the only strawberry.
I tried forever to match it, could not do it.
Impossible. It's the only strawberry protein shake that was
tastes like strawberry.
That tastes like strawberry. That didn't taste like it. Like that
pink.
Yeah.
Everything else tasted like pink, but not strawberry.
Yeah, like every other one of them tastes like that fluoride you get on your teeth when you're getting your teeth. Like just this horrible, tinny, metallic, like simulation of strawberry, whereas theirs was like – I actually chose to drink theirs, whereas all the other strawberries I thought were gross. Yeah. And I've never, ever seen anyone get it ever since. So, I mean
– do you remember when not to name – the supplement companies that we used to work for, but when we were both working at a certain supplement company and you refused to take their strawberry, so you had Mesotech in your desk and you almost got busted.
because it was so good. It was just so much better than everything else. And I don't even know why anybody tried to make strawberry next to theirs.
You had contraband your desk. It was awesome.
Yeah. It was so good. And I mean, you just can't mess with flavor systems. Like I remember working on new bar flavors. And people who were, you know, we worked for a particular supplement company that had a very well-selling protein bar that had it was the industry leader in taste. It was the best tasting bar by a mile. And we had other companies competing to come up with a, you know, better flavor, better taste. And it was super picky. Like you can't mess with that one because it was, customers really expected it to be just like the one they remembered. You can't really. You can't throw a curveball at them. People aren't going to accept it.
You know what a major mistake that a lot of newbie supplement people make is they taste test right out of manufacturing. And you can't do that because you have to wait for very non-technical terms, but kind of everything to settle down a bit and mellow out. So the way something tastes right off the first run is always going to be drastically different the way it's going to taste. Even most of the time, it's only a day or two later. With protein bars, it was often like you had to wait a couple weeks.
Mm. Oh, yeah. Yeah, interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. Especially back in the high protein bar days when we were just using glycerin or glycerol, sorry, as like a non whatever the story was. Basically, we tried to use glycerol, not claim it as a carbohydrate. But the glycerol would eventually sort of spread its flavor across the whole bar, and it would kind of mature in a very weird way over weeks and weeks after manufacturing.
Yeah, we've also made the mistake of with a pre-workout supplement of taste testing it at one dose. And everyone liked the one dose, but by the end of a month of it, people found it way too much.
Mm-hmm.
So it was like, it's the Coke Pepsi thing. It's like Coke wins head to head, but then Pepsi wins after multiple tastes.
Oh, really? I didn't know that.
Something like that. Yeah. So we did that and we had like, and so we went with the flavor that everyone liked when they tasted it once. But then once the thing went to production and people were buying it and had a month's supply, about halfway through the month, they're like, that's just too sweet. I can't handle another day of that.
Mm-hmm.
And we were like, oh, we never thought of it that way. We never thought of dosing it for a month straight. And then the problem came in that the customers were comparing it to other well-known brands. So the customers had experience dosing other products for an entire month. So they had an image in their head of what something over a month, how they should be able to handle it. And the one we came out with, on a one-off head-to-head taste test, tasted better, but over the course of a month, it was too sweet and too rich to handle for a month straight. So it was a tough lesson to learn.
Oh, totally. Have you ever done, I did some product development on a post-workout drink, and wasn't until I was almost done when I realized it actually tastes drastically different post-workout than it did when you just sit in your office.
Oh, yeah, after you work out, your palate changes, yeah.
Yeah, that was almost luckily I caught that one, but that was a bit of a...
Now your ability to sense sweetness is different.
Yeah, there was a sweetness was the issue, too, yeah.
So it becomes too sweet.
Yeah.
So the thing needs to be bland, a little bit more bland. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, but that's stuff you would never think of, right?
Right.
But the customer, if they're taking it post-workout, they're going to be hyper-aware of that.
Well, totally. Absolutely. And the cool thing is the flavor houses is another thing you'd see at one of these supply shows, and really interesting to get their take on supplements. And they'll have ingredients that they absolutely hate working with, and they'll have ingredients they love, and they'll have, you know, maybe they like casein but not whey, but it's really cool to hear their sort of side of the story.
Yeah, and that's like you just said, the challenges working with specific ingredients. There could be scientifically really good evidence why a particular ingredient could be included in a product. And then you get to the manufacturing level and you find out that most manufacturers aren't even outfitted to work with that ingredient or refuse to work with it or
capsaicin.
Yeah, capsaicin. Oof. It's you could blow up your factory with capsaicin. So most people won't touch it. It may have significant clinical benefits, but no one wants to touch it and make it. So it's kind of the scientific research is there that it could work if anyone would bother actually manufacturing it.
Oh, yeah. Well, could you imagine if we discovered a potential weight loss ingredient out of, like, I don't know, like peanut shells or something like that? I think about the manufacturing problems with that, right? Like introducing peanuts into plants, the one thing that manufacturing people absolutely hate.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Right, is dealing with stuff like that. So, yeah, there's all sorts of little intricacies in the behind the scenes from the raw material all the way up it make it a very fun industry to kind of pay attention to.
Yeah, and that's why just because there's a research study done on a particular ingredient, it doesn't mean it's necessarily market viable.
Or do you ever see it in a product, especially if it ends up being like, I don't know, 10, you know, $300 a kilo or something like that. It's probably not going to make it into a supplement.
Yeah, there's two things going on there. There's the clinical applicability, like in a lab. So let's say you can get a particular ingredient processed and manufactured, just like, you know, 1 pound of it, so some scientists can work with it. That's a lot different than having it run at full production for a national release. in thousands and thousands of pounds and in thousands and thousands of kilograms. And so what you're looking at there is, okay, so you have proof of concept in a scientific laboratory, and then you're like, well, can we actually scale this up and make it for national distribution? And there's a difference. Like, I remember looking at certain ingredients where they looked really good from a scientific standpoint. They would have great claims. They would like be game changers as far as an ingredient. And then you realize that the amount that the scientists were dosing in people in their study, the cost would have been hundreds and hundreds of dollars per person.
Yeah.
And per month. And we're like, okay, that's not viable. There's no way we could actually, we're not going to make a $500 a month supplement. This is just impossible.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, but somebody will browse around.
And you meant game changer in terms of the claims, not the effect.
Oh, game changer in terms of the claims. Like, it would be like, no one could compete with this claim.
Yeah.
And, but then you look at the cost and you're like, well, yeah, but that's,
no one can compete with this cost either.
No, the cost is too high. So you're, but the thing is, the published research, someone could, you know, find this paper or papers on this particular, you know, compound and be like, well, how come people don't have this? And it's like, well, because you can't manufacture it it's not yet anyways. It's not possible to manufacture it cost effectively. So it's kind of the idea is there, but the economics isn't there yet.
Yeah, exactly.
Well,
perfect.
Okay, so
All right, where are we at
with this one?
I think we're just telling stories on this one.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's just basically some background into sub-ministry. All right, we can just by-life it simply by saying that it's, you know, it's always more fun to look at the entire history of something, you know, and why some claims are the way they are, some products are the way they are. It's always more involved than we're led to believe.
Mm-hmm. And then again, I guess with supplements and even in the food industry, the product you actually get is the combination of both its the economics of the product plus its scientific, you know, claims and what it actually can and can't do. And it's not just based on, you know, the scientific part of it or how it works in your body. It's always a combination of that and whether or not it's even viable from an economic standpoint to even bring it to market.
Yeah.
All right.
All right. I'm done.
All right. Me too. All right, so for Brad Peelan, I'm John Barbin, and that's your Phi Life podcast.